advocacy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel on Dialogue Conspiracy, number 216, September 29th, 1975. And Dialogue Conspiracy comes from Carmel, California. I have a serious matter to bring up before my listeners, and I'm considering whether or not to call it quits on Dialogue Conspiracy and go off the air at this point for the following reason, and I thought I would share it with you and see how you feel about it. This last Wednesday night, September 24th, I received a telephone call from a person impersonating an officer from the Carmel Police Department. He identified himself as Captain Crystal. The name went very fast, but he gave a name. And he told me that my daughter, who attends college classes at night, was under custody for having been picked up on Carmel Beach. And I said, what was she doing there, or something to that effect. And he said, don't worry about it, she's all right. That she had a lid and a half of marijuana. And nobody was hurt except that I had to go down to release her. The parent that's involved has to go down to the jail. And it sounded very official sounding. There was no indication of a hoax with the message at all. I would have grabbed my purse. I was ready to do it and leave two people who were in the house and go on down to the jail to the Carmel Police Department, which is about 10 miles from my home. It's down a dark road, Carmel Valley Road, and people who don't know the location. It's not lit up at night, and there's a lot of quiet spots along the road into Carmel, about 10 miles into town, and then 10 miles back to the house. And this party on the phone hung up before I had a chance to finish, after they reassured me no problems involved, that these young people were there and a group of them had been brought in. It was a warm summer evening here. It happened to be the hottest day of the year, and so I thought maybe she had cut classes. I knew she was supposed to be in school. And I looked at my calendar and had a videotape, a voice telephone conversation for a show back in Minneapolis at 9 o'clock. And I picked up the phone to call down to the Carmel Police Department to say that I would not be there for about an hour and a half, that she shouldn't worry. And when I called down there, there was nobody there by that name, and nobody had been picked up at Carmel Beach, which I heard clearly thought I heard the first time. So I called the police in the neighboring areas of Pacific Grove and Seaside, Monterey, and the sheriff's office, and there were no arrests, and nobody was picked up. Then I called school, and my daughter was located in her class. Now, the purpose of this message only was one of two things, either to clear me out of the house, which wouldn't make much sense because two other people were at the house at the time and it was well lit. But then the other possibility, the more dangerous possibility, is what I think of as a Jimmy Hoffa treatment. The only way I would have gotten out in the house at night alone, going down the road like that, perfectly confident that I had a destination and back, was through the use of one of my children, to believe that one of my children needed me or was in trouble, or an official of this kind, this voice, could pull me right out of the chair, grab my purse, and go. And it was only that 9 o'clock call that stopped me, because she was not there. And the same day, Paul Krasner, who publishes The Realist in my articles, received a telephone call, which I didn't know about until 2 days later when we were talking on the telephone on Friday. He received a call from somebody who both of us have suspected of being an infiltrator and an agent provocateur in the San Francisco area for the past 3 years, who's tried to get on top of both of us, and we've kicked her out of both residences. And she called him just the same day and said, I understand that your daughter, who used to live in the East, is living with you and going to school now, because he'd written about her moving out here in the Berkeley Barb. And he said, yes. And this girl said, what school does she attend? And Paul said, oh, one of the schools around here, and didn't think anything of it. So whether it's a coincidence or a pattern or something in the future, I have to keep it in mind, and I have to think, you know, what my alternatives are. You read in the newspapers more accounts of what the intelligence agencies are capable of doing. There was an article today, September 29th, the plan to get Jack Anderson earlier at the Watergate hearing, not on the hearings, but the Watergate defendant, Jeb MacGruber, had talked about plans that Liddy was going out to kill Jack Anderson. But in the paper today, there was an article that they had four ways that they were considering getting Jack Anderson. And when I say they, I don't mean some ordinary hoodlums or bums on the street or people with past criminal records. I mean White House officials, the attorney for the President of the United States, Mr. Colson, Charles Colson, allegedly is working with E. Howard Hunt, served the government 21 years in official capacities. One, they considered giving him a drug before a live radio appearance so he'd ramble incoherently. The second was a different kind of a dirty trick, which Charles Colson was Department of Dirty Tricks. It was to spread a drug on the steering wheel of Anderson's car, and then that drug would enter his body through the skin. Now, the article didn't go on to say if he would die subsequently from that kind of a steering wheel, where you rub the steering wheel of a car or not. But this was one of the plans, so you see how insidious these gentlemen are working. The third was to slip a hallucinogenic into his medicine cabinet by Jack Anderson to go in the house and put it into the pill bottle that he takes. And they ruled that out because they weren't sure which pills he'd be taking at the time. But you can see with the counterintelligence program that Richard Nixon formed, the Tom Charles Houston plan we'll go into, that a burglary entering homes wasn't only to find radicals or terrorists of the 1960s and 70s at all. It wasn't because they were a threat to the presidency. Journalists or news people like myself, maybe they can go in and find a medicine bottle, and eventually you'll get it if it's close to the front of the medicine cabinet. And the fourth thing was to put something in Anderson's drink at a cocktail party, but they ruled out he doesn't drink. But this is the White House team, the White House attorney, the White House employees, considering entering a home illegally with their capable locksmiths from the CIA and putting some medicine that could be fatal into a medicine bottle, or going to your car and putting it on the steering wheel of the car and having a drug enter your body through your skin. What kind of poison is that? I thought when I got this call and that I was supposed to go down these dark 10 miles one way and back, when I found out she wasn't there, return home, if I was lucky, heading one of two ways, of Jimmy Hoffa, who had a luncheon date. And when he went to the restaurant, he called his wife and said the persons he was to meet weren't there, identified that he was at the restaurant, then he never showed up again. Murray Chotiner, who worked for the White House, he was the Dirty Tricks Department before Charles Colson, was a connecting link to the milk funds of Richard Nixon and to a lot of the scandals going on at the Watergate that were exposed by Watergate. He could have been a good witness against Mr. Maurice Stans and John Mitchell. And he was hit by a government truck. It was a hit-run accident on a Sunday taking place right in front of Ted Kennedy's home. He died of injuries, and his wife placed a suit against the federal government. I read the article that she placed the suit. I haven't heard any more about it. Clay Shaw was a defendant in a case, Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, alleged Clay Shaw was part of the Kennedy assassination conspiracy, and he was a CIA agent who worked with David Ferry. And Shaw worked with the Nazis that came over here from Germany after World War II. His headquarters were the Trade Mart in New Orleans. And when it became public through Victor Marchetti's book and other people speaking in Mexico about Clay Shaw being in Mexico, the time Oswald was there with David Ferry and with an Albert Osborne. And then Clay Shaw was hit by an automobile, and he died of injuries, and he was cremated immediately. There was no autopsy. The circumstances were mysterious, and he was hit by a car. There was another, Peter James, who worked for the CIA as an informant, and he worked at the Pratt and Whitney Aircraft Company, propellant engineer he was, and he, one of the agents at the factory, warned him that if he was doing a book and researching government operations on Air Force technology, that he would be in danger. And Peter James had an article in the Washington Post written by Lawrence Stern, March 14, 1974, that the CIA agents came to them and a Air Force official of special investigation said, in quotes, that he had friends who can arrange an automobile accident. And the surveillance was so heavy on James that he and his wife returned to the United States immediately. There was a Wayne Allen McKinney who worked in the Library of Congress, and he was investigating controversial tax matters at the time of the Watergate. There were things that would come up regarding possibly Richard Nixon's taxes and other tax problems of Watergate persons. And in December 73, he left the Library of Congress, and it was a hit-run case with his car. And they also found bullets in his body. He was out on Lone Road, and there were bullets in his body. Philip Agee, the CIA official who left the CIA and wrote the book Inside the Company, said he had firsthand knowledge of many previously unrevealed CIA operations, and that at least one of the killings he knew involved the use of a truck to run over a recently utilized local CIA operative once the mission was accomplished. Robert Crown, the very well-known assemblyman in California, was jogging one morning early, and Crown was just about to come into a decision on the death penalty in California, a very controversial decision because our political patsies that are locked up can be eliminated legally so that we never get a chance to get these conspiracy trials going straight. And Philip and Robert Crown was jogging, and I charged at the time the circumstances, the direction he was hit, the person who ran over him. It was all very cloudy. We lost a very good assemblyman in Sacramento, and his fellow assemblymen all mourned heavily like they do when the Kennedys or Martin Luther King are killed. And then they dropped the whole matter, and he was run over, and that was the end of Robert Crown. So we know those things are happening, and we know that people do impersonate police officers. The most recent case in my files is a case of a murder back in Maryland, right on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., and several girls' bodies, they were all black girls, were murdered. They were found very close to a freeway, and the murders were called the Phantom Freeway Murders because nobody could figure out who was doing these series of murders. There was a murder spree, and they were done at random. All victims were young black girls, around 14, petite, cute girls. All bodies were found near major highways east of Washington, D.C., all accepted rides before they were killed. They were picked up in an area between school and home, something like that. We were taken far from home, so they were taken in cars. And none of their bodies show sign of a struggle, and they weren't raped. They were just shot. One was shot in the head, and then they were taken underneath a particular freeway at different times the bodies were left there. And the families began to believe that there were law enforcement agents involved in this because a whole bunch of girls of this age wouldn't trust and get into cars, knowing the girls and their habits, the parents said, except if it was a policeman or law enforcement agent. So April 1st, 1974, two men were arrested, Edward Leon Selman and Tommy Bernard Simmons, and they were accused and charged with at least one of the murders. On the tip of an informant, I believe it was the wife of one of these men, that they were involved in shooting one of the girls in the back of the head. They haven't been charged with all of the murders because there's not enough evidence. But the information, as I say, came up from a tip-off. And these were police officers in Washington, D.C., right outside of Maryland, who were responsible for shooting at least one girl in the head. And there were a whole series, and evidently in the uniform of the police officer. So the decision, I have to make the decision with my own family, of how far I want to go into this research publicly, how much can be done to stop this syndrome, and how can I be useful without jeopardizing my own family. As a result of this phone call, I felt maybe it is time for me to stop my programs at KLRB, which I've done since 1971 in May when the Pentagon Papers story broke. If I were alone and had no family and just had to make the decision whether to keep on going publicly and expose myself, I think I would stand the risk or the dangers and speak up or split the country quickly if I could only speak for myself, but I can't. I do have a family, and that's the prime consideration, and I don't want to jeopardize them. When somebody uses my daughter, then they know where she is, and I just don't want to jeopardize them anymore. We've had a series of incidences in the family. A lot of people ask us, how come you're still alive? How come you haven't been hurt? Do you ever get threats? I've never received a death threat in the mail, stop the work, or else. I've never received a letter saying you're going to be killed. I've never had anything like that. But we have had our series of incidences. I've talked at great length, I think, at KLRB long enough about an agent who I can name, Carolyn Gilman. I believe that she and her husband, Peter Gilman, who live in this community, I don't care if they want to sue or not. In circumstantial evidence, I can say positively that in 1967, when I was at Jim, working with Jim Garrison, New Orleans, this particular woman gave my son an acid, which made him immediately become suicidal and desperately ill. And after many, many years since 67 of medication and help by psychiatrists and a good lot of attention, he is coming out of what happened but gets relapses from that day when he was attending UC Santa Cruz and ingested something and then went totally berserk against all medical diagnosis except the kind of thing which the CIA was using at 67. And I saved all my correspondence with the doctors and various people and alleged at the time that this is what happened. And now if you read your news, you see their capability. The second mishap in my family was when my car caught fire up in Oregon at Grants Pass coming home from a vacation in Canada. Somebody was in my hotel room in Vancouver that morning. They got out real fast and ran out the door. I came back from breakfast, and they're going, a woman, allegedly a maid, going through a suitcase. And that same day, later in the day, a shoe pin had or part had been removed from under my car, and the car was about to go up in flames, and through a set of circumstances, it was put out, luckily. And then 6 weeks later, we did have a fatal car crash in our family, and my daughter, Bonnie Brussel, who was 14 at the time, was killed, and Barbara Brussel was in the car with her, and three other people were killed. And a man from Fort Ord, another person, Mr. Zavoni, who was hit from behind, was permanently injured, his arms and legs and his neck broken. And a man from Fort Ord by the name of Garcia walked away, one of the passengers, totally unscratched, never was hurt again, and never appeared. On KGO last week, Jim Eason had a man on there, I understand, Bruce Roberts, who has done a lot of work on the Gemstone files. Bruce Roberts contacted me in 72, and he's the gentleman who gave me the information on the barrel of Howard Hughes and a lot of information of things that have been coming out on the Watergate in the last few years. And he told me that Carlos Marcellus at Lynx in California and gave me the names of three people in California who were responsible for that automobile crash. And I have saved as much documentation and evidence on that, and I hopefully would pursue two lawsuits in any length of time that I can to get this circumstantial evidence on the board, because the CIA has admitted that they have destroyed their actual evidence of these drug cases. In March 72, my car caught fire again. It didn't catch up in flames, but the brakes burned out and the car was burned out. There was a steel plate to protect it this time. It was a Saab, built differently than the Mercury I had, but it was completely, it was burned, the motor was burned, and the flames didn't start, but the car was ruined. And then in 1974, in the fall of 74, a gentleman came into my home. He was introduced through a neighbor, and they visited allegedly socially for a little while. And when he got up, he said to me, beware of intersections. And I thought he just came to meet me for my research and heard me on KLRB. And I ran after him and I said, is that a threat you're giving me? And he said, just beware of intersections. And I was outraged, and I went to my neighbor and asked the next day, what's going on? Who is this man and what's happening? And he said, oh, he made the words that he raises money for political campaigns and for Pierre Salinger. He's a bag man for Hughes, and he's a soldier of fortune who has various political jobs. And 3 weeks later, when I was coming up a fairly steep hill that turns off Carmel Valley Road to come to my house, just as I got to the top of the hill, a red Volkswagen came scooping down in front of the hill, and a car in front of me stopped short of that, and I went right into that. And as luck would have it, only my car was crashed. We never saw the little red Volkswagen again or knew who it was. He didn't stop. Nothing happened in the car in front, but again, my car was smashed up, and it was quite lengthy expense and shock. And So I feel that that was not very comfortable and scary, in lieu of the fact that I'd been warned of intersections, and that was one on the way to my house. I will know in another week or two. I will say that this probably will be my last show on KLRB. I would like to go to colleges and give lectures and get out a newsletter. I don't feel comfortable meeting large audiences publicly, big groups like I did in New York City, maybe at the Elgin Theater I would. But as far as being on the radio, I was doing many shows last week when the Patty Hearst story broke and the Manson girl broke, Squeaky Fromm, and from all over the country I was doing radio shows. And when you begin to reach hundreds of thousands of people, or maybe several million, and the response comes in, and people are listening now for the first time, and they write that they really understand, and now they see these interlocking connections, then I know that the information I have is probably very powerful. There isn't a place that I lecture that people don't say, "How come you're still alive?" And I always say that I'd never speak in front of Madison Square Garden like Malcolm X did. But I'm doing the same thing by being on the radio. The show is syndicated. It goes to many cities. And so that is a decision that I'll have to make within the next week, whether I want to go ahead and appear publicly. I would like to write the book that I have the outline of called Murderville USA. And it's a format that goes after the way that Nazi Germany came into effect. And speaking of Nazi Germany, there were all these terrorist activities, and the illegal government created terrorism, like you're going to see in America, in order to manipulate the legal system. And one of the tricks they did was the large series of political assassinations that ran into 300 or 400 people that the military gave orders to that they should be eliminated, and that the lawsuits would be covered up in the courts. And the role of the courts was very tricky. This is written in a book, the article, it's called The Clandestine Rearmament of Germany. And the role of the law courts was written by Mr. E.J. Gumbel, who lived in Nazi Germany. And this is what he says. He said, "The political assassinations committed by members of the secret armies put a heavy burden on the administration of justice. The murderers had to be acquitted, and the victims had to be shown as guilty. This task was fulfilled by the employment of using their military courts that sided with the men when they were accused of murder. They had slow trials. They were unable to find the guilty people. They issued false papers of identity. The police helped them out. And they accepted at face value all the claims of the accused murderer. The guilty one was let go, and the innocent was locked up. And if he tried to escape, they killed him." And Gumbel talked about the use of the courts, and this is what you're seeing in this country, hundreds of murders that are taking place, and the court is being manipulated. And then in Nazi Germany, they used something which is similar to this new crime bill that was going through. He said, "For the protection of secret armaments, an illegal rearmament of Germany until Hitler got into power, the law courts, following the Supreme Court, issued a new idea, high treason committed by the press. In English, the phrase was high treason. First, to prepare for revolution or to aid the enemy in the time of war was treason. Second, stealing secret governments with the intent to transmit them to present or potential enemy or foreign power was treason. By stopping publications, aiming at stopping illegal actions committed by branches of the government," this is any person who showed that the government was acting illegally, "you could interpret that as high treason. Anyone who had information that the existing government was illegal in anything they were doing, that person could be charged with treason for exposing it." And Mr. Gumbel said, "The accusation of high treason was the big weapon of the defense system of Nazi Germany, and this is how the Nazis got to power, by using this, that you're aiding the enemy by revealing what they were doing while they were doing these hundreds of political assassinations. To ensure the sentences, officers of the Reichswehr responsible for the secret rearmament of Germany were called as witnesses for the prosecution in these law cases. In order to terrorize the public, many more trials were started than could ever be completed." Now, this has been happening, these series of murders, murders that you read about in the newspapers, and these attempted murders of Gerald Ford. There will be a real one that takes place in our next elections. And I would like to write the book Murderville USA on certain airplane crashes, actors, black leaders, Black Panthers, Chicanos, children of persons who've been political, civil rights leaders, murders on campuses, murders of congressmen, murders from drug testing, entertainment, government employees, family massacres, certain hijackers, certain hippies, inventors, judges, labor leaders, lawyers, mafia leaders, medical tests, various musicians, rock musicians, black Muslim leaders, Indian leaders, police informers, provocateurs that have been murdered, prisoners, political prisoners that have been murdered, and then witnesses to various important trials like to the Wallace shooting, the John Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King murder. And I would like to write a book, maybe several volumes, called Murderville USA that goes into the murders of people like Adlai Stevenson, Dag Hammarskjöld, Patrice Lumumba, Diem Nasser, Chambé, Jacobo Guzman, the Guatemalan ex-president, Che Guevara, James Forrestal, Estes Key Bauer, Black Panthers like Fred Hampton and Mrs. Pratt, Geronimo Pratt's wife and Bobby Hinton, George Jackson, Ruben Salazar, the Chicano, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and Whitney Young, and the links of about 20 musicians and murders and attempted murders. And I think that maybe I will not be on the air. I'll decide between this week and next week on my public and private life, and maybe I'll just sit and think of my options of where I want to go and what I want to do and how far I want to go and how far can I go. Because I said this is a military coup. In 1963, the country was overthrown. And now you have to think of counterintelligence like the Free French did. You have to think of some way of counteracting the police force that has taken over this state particularly and is moving eastward. Whatever happens in California, it's going to go on to the East Coast. One other matter, I received a letter today from Elmer Davis. This came just on top of that other phone call I had. Elmer Davis is the gentleman that I've had on my program many times. I helped him get out of Folsom Prison. He stayed with us here in Carmel for 8 months, and he sued John Ehrlichman and E. Howard Hunt and Egil Crow, G. Gordon Liddy, and the Beverly Hills Police for naming him as a scapegoat, having his parole violated, and he was at Folsom Prison at the time that the trial of Dr. Ellsberg came, and he was named for doing the burglary at Dr. Lewis Fielding's office. And Delmer Davis was with us here in Carmel for 8 months, and in the pursuit of his law case, I asked him to go down to Los Angeles because he was commuting once a month or once in 3 weeks. It was too expensive, and you can't run a $2 million lawsuit from Carmel. I don't have the money to do it, and I couldn't help him pass the 8 months of serving the defendants and finding them and getting the court order and getting his past trial transcripts and everything the way it should be for him. And when I asked him to leave, he would not leave Carmel. And at that time, on May 29th, he assaulted me and jumped on my head and almost killed me. And I did mention a few injuries on the air, but I feel I should talk about it at this time. And stomped on my head. And at the time, the sheriff and the parole officer wanted me to press charges. And I didn't want to put a man back into Folsom for the rest of his life. I thought he should be able to pursue this large case. He'd studied law for 11 years, and I believed in what he was doing, and I wanted to see him do it. And I did not press charges if he would get off the Monterey Peninsula, and it took me all summer to recuperate. I'm just getting over it now. It's been 3 months of head injuries. I would not pursue this thing. But he has been coming back in contact with me, and I received what I considered a threatening letter today. I've told him if he came back, his parole would be violated. If he came in the house, he would be charged with trespassing. And he wrote me a letter just today that I'm coming to see you. This is from Elmer Davis. I'm coming to see you, and no one, including the police, or he mentioned my son, will be able to stop me. And he said he's going to curtail things that I might be doing at the house. I'm coming to Carmel. So you make preparations, and I want you to meet me at the bus terminal. You're going to have to accept me as I am or not at all, and I'm coming to Monterey or Carmel to see you if it means the jail. And then he said, forgive me for writing this missile. But this is how I feel. Give my regards to the family. Elmer Davis, the Watergate scapegoat. Well, if a man has nowhere to go between Los Angeles and Folsom Prison, and he knows that by coming to my house he's going to jail, I take it that he could possibly assault me again. Somebody who was at the home to help him move his things to the Greyhound station was almost killed. Elmer grabbed a scissors and went into a stance, and his friend was into a karate stance, and we broke that up and took that weapon away. But he had knocked me down, and he had been a fighter in the ring, and knocked me down with his fist to the floor before he stamped my head and started stamping it many times. And he is warned that he's coming back. So then I have questions in my mind. Here's a 47-year-old man who's done 11 years law research, who has carried his case through the courts for 2 years and is doing very well. Was in court last Tuesday. And why would he jeopardize that $2 million lawsuit? He has a very good chance of settlement, a clear-cut case, to come up here and go back to Folsom Prison with a stop to Monterey, unless he has been promised possibly a settlement to get off if he comes up here. This, on top of that other phony police hoax, scares me, to put it lightly. I've never been frightened in the 4.5 years I've been on the air, 13 years of research. I've had a lot of mishaps, my family, as you can understand, but I've never had a feeling that it's closing in on me. And I thought by going publicly and sharing it with you, because many of you are friends of mine who have listened to this program and taped it for many years. Some of you are new listeners, but many of you have listened for a long, long time. So I'm stuck with this dilemma of protecting myself and my family, and this person threatening to come up, no, even if it means jail. And we leave an open end. It's an open end till next week. And if I'm not on Dialogue Conspiracy next week, you'll understand, but I have to make that decision with my family. I do want to go briefly into some of the things that are happening in San Francisco. In the remaining time we have, Senator Frank Church accused the CIA just this last week at his hearings of paying no heed to the orders to revoke the Tom Charles Houston plan. Frank Church said the federal intelligence agencies, that's Navy intelligence, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, and the CIA, went ahead with a variety of illegal acts, and they did not heed any order of the president to revoke those acts. He gave an example of the germ warfare, but I know that the Tom Charles Houston plan that was set into operation in 1970 of opening houses or burglaries did not end then, and that Richard Nixon, captive in the White House in a sense, or else had blinders on his eyes, ordered the thing put together. He was told to put it through, but when he didn't go along with it, when it was in quotes rescinded, the COINTEL program went on. The COINTEL program is the SLA in San Francisco. That's exactly what it is. Tom Charles Houston plan is not dead. Their last brahu, or their current brahu, is a series of kidnappings and terrorisms that's been taking place. Richard Nixon sent a memo in June 6, 1970, orders to the intelligence and military intelligence, the United States government, and this is what it said. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of people, mostly under 30, are determined to destroy our society. Our people, perhaps in reaction to the excesses of the McCarthy era, are unwilling to admit that their children might want to destroy the country. And therefore, in 1970, he began the COINTEL program. Now, Mr. Charles Bates, who is already being suggested to become the next head of the FBI to take over the job of Clarence Kelly, is an agent of the FBI whose background goes back to Intelligence Division. He is a team of the Intelligence Division, born in Austin, Texas. He went to FBI school and law school, was out in 1942. In 1957, he became part of the Intelligence Division supervision in Washington, D.C., and then went to the American Embassy in Britain for 7 years as a liaison with Scotland Yard and British intelligence agencies as a legal attaché. And I said that the conspiracies, all the assassinations and the murders that I've been talking about have come from the importation of Reinhard Gehlen's agents from World War II, Nazi agents from World War II, combined with British intelligence and the United States government made their headquarters in the Bahamas. And their actual headquarters come out of the Defense Industry Security Command. 7 years after working with British intelligence, Charles Bates went to Omaha briefly in 65, then went to Chicago in 68 at the time of the riots where Bernard Barker was and E. Howard Hunt, the convention riots, and managed to get that careful conspiracy trial, the Chicago conspiracy trial, going and getting convictions. And Mrs. Moore, who was arrested this week, said that she couldn't get out of the FBI because they ordered her to get convictions for them in the Bay Area of these radicals. Mr. Bates went in 1971 when the Houston plan was rolling full speed to Washington, D.C., full work in the intelligence division, and in 72, he was in charge of the FBI investigation of the Watergate, which you know went absolutely nowhere and was covered up all the FBI involvement, including the Wallace shooting, the Mary Jo Kopechne murder, and the J. Edgar Hoover murders, so they could use the Tom Charles Houston plan. And the plans for martial law and the Howard Hughes money, all of this was covered up. Charles Bates' next assignment was to San Francisco in 1972. He arrived in San Francisco in 72, the same time that Colston Westbrook, who worked with the Central Intelligence Agency, arrived from Southeast Asia with 7 years' work in behavior modification to set up the Black Cultural Association in Vacaville Prison. In 1972, in San Diego, the book Black Abductor was published by a non-existing press, a non-existing Regency Publishing, an author, Harrison James, who never surfaced, that I suspect was written again by spy master E. Howard Hunt. And E. Howard Hunt in 72 was very much part of the White House. Mr. Bates was very much part of the White House. They were, and Mr. McCord, all part of FBI intelligence, each taking a new assignment and getting ready for terrorism to get arrests and break up the youth movement that Richard Nixon said would destroy the country. Any person under 30 would destroy the country. It was also in San Francisco where Mr. Bates was working that prison violence was beginning. The zebra killings were being set up in 72. Then came the murder of Dr. Foster and the presentation of the Seminese Liberation Army. Now, Sarah Moore has been sent to an isolation. I read today she's been placed in total isolation, the woman who worked for the FBI who allegedly was going to shoot Gerald Ford. She wasn't taken on an airplane. She was taken in a 9-hour automobile trip. She's not on a ward with anybody else. She was taken in an underground tunnel. She's put on a separate floor on a jail in San Diego, a new jail. They've canceled any sharing of communal dining room or watching color TV with any female. She's been put on stringent communication with any other person. Who orders this and why? Sarah Moore is down in San Diego with orders by the warden. They changed the original plan. She can't mingle with anybody. She's on the 9th floor of a high-rise facility. Well, Sarah Moore revealed the war plans of Mr. Bates and Mr. William Colby, who came home from the Phoenix program in Southeast Asia to head the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington, with Charlie Bates heading the terrorism and the Central Intelligence Phoenix program in San Francisco. And Sarah Moore said a few things before her isolation because the early accounts are interesting. She said that she worked for the FBI, and the FBI confirmed that she worked for them. She wanted to get out of the FBI as an informer. This is what Sarah Moore said. This is the Los Angeles Times, September 23rd, 1975. She wanted to get out of the FBI as an informer, but they told her they needed her. They said, we have to have a middle-class lady to go out and save the country. You see, an earth mother, right? Go out and save the country. The picture they painted for her was to make a middle-class lady go out there and do what she was told she had to do, working in the food grant program and infiltrating for alcohol, tobacco, and firearm for the FBI and the San Francisco police. And two of those agencies, the police and the alcohol, tobacco, and firearm, provided two of her weapons. The agents told her that these people were out to destroy the country. This is what she said, that these people were out to destroy the country. And those are the exact words that Richard Nixon said in 1970, go after them. They're out to destroy the country. In 1975, she has an interview that she was told that the agents, the FBI, said, you can't get out of your assignment. You have to do it. They told her that these young people were dupes of foreign governments, the KGB and the Red Chinese. And Mrs. Moore was told, this is a war. Now, those were the words that G. Gordon Liddy was saying in 1972, and when he was arrested. This is the attitude that Louis Tackwood said that the Los Angeles Police Department criminal conspiracy section said, this is a war. This is what Mrs. Moore was told, this is a war. That's what Charlie Bates knows and Mr. Colby knows. And Mrs. Moore said, I'll tell you, this is her quotation from the LA Times, I'll tell you, there's not a single agent in the FBI intelligence section. Now, that's not all, but in the intelligence section, there's not absolutely dead serious about it, absolutely dedicated and absolutely sincere. And they told her to go work with the Freaky Fringe, and she loaned radical leader Popeye Jackson $2,000, and he had smashed up her car. Lynette Squeaky Frome, who allegedly wanted to shoot the president 2 weeks earlier, was given a Cadillac by a man who worked at McClellan Air Force Base for 30 years. And then she also smashed that car and was given a new 73 Toyota. And Mrs. Moore said that she was hired to neutralize the entire movement or help neutralize the movement. And when she wanted to break off her relationship with the FBI, she went to the Berkeley Bar, but she was told that she couldn't break it off. And the night before Gerald Ford was in town and the day before she warned the Secret Service, they looked out for a Palo Alto. They knew who she was, and she wanted to get out of it, but she had a control, a CIA control, alcohol, tobacco, and firearm control. When the police took her gun on Sunday night, she called at 3 in the morning, and the same man who has supplied guns from the alcohol, tobacco, firearms, gave her a gun the next morning under the escort of an agent of alcohol, tobacco, and firearm. She said she never had any intention to kill Gerald Ford, but now the good story that people are out to kill him, that there's a lot of kooks in California, will make a good cover story, and he'll keep coming out here, and we'll have to worry about Gerald Ford. But you can see the difference in treatment between Sarah Moore and Squeaky Fromm. One got a book publisher, one got off murder raps, three various murder raps, and has a long list of charges, had people speak up for her like Marilyn Baker, and a district attorney from Los Angeles, character references, and she's allowed to be her own lawyer, and she's seen on national TV, and her roommate Sandra Good's on TV. And Sarah Moore, who worked for the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, who was earning $50,000 a year before she went to people in need, and we don't know who her husbands are. A lot of unanswered questions about her, a graduate accountant from UCLA, an important woman, married to a doctor who worked 2 years ago, 4 years ago, who works at Kaiser Permanente Hospital. Now, this husband works for Kaiser, and it was Kaiser that published the very first book that I talked about last week, put out by an agent provocateur who supplied drug and acid, the Manson family, came from money from the Kaiser people to do the artwork for a book the Kaiser put out called Children of Change. And this Mrs. Moore's husband, former husband, is a doctor several years ago, works at Kaiser. How close does this have to be? Working with the government. She's locked up. She's put on the ninth floor. Nobody can see Mrs. Moore. Nobody can interview her. She can have a lobotomy, electric lobotomy, have her brain removed. How can we allow her to go to San Diego to get the Dita Baird treatment or the Martha Mitchell treatment or something worth? She already said she's part of the COINTEL program. She's using the same words that the people are destroying the country, that she had to immobilize the radicals. And now the whole left or left movement in San Francisco is broken up. The whole youth movement will be broken up. It's all infiltrated. It's a terrible situation, and it's going to continue. And I would like to be on next week. I'm not promising I will. Chances are I won't. You'll just have to listen and see if I get the clue that am I safe? Do I feel safe? If my family feels safe? If they don't, I won't be on KLRB next week. I'll miss you. I'll leave my options open, but for now we'll say goodbye and we'll see what next week brings. It's Mae Brussel from KLRB in Carmel, California.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB FM in Carmel, California.